And now Iowa Contemporary Art presents Icon Art Radio.
Hi, this is Bill Teeple, Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. This month, we are celebrating the grand opening of our brand new Icon Gallery on the Square, and we have an exhibit of 27 of the top artists that have shown in with Icon over the last 5 years in the old gallery that was on the third floor up above the square. And we have two of the most illustrious members of that group of artists here today with us at Icon Art Radio, and it's Michael and Charlotte Kane, who are iconic figures in the Fairfield art scene. And really the whole of art scene of Fairfield, I think, is kind of built on the rock of the Canes. I don't know where we want to get this started. There's so many directions we can go. They have been in India for how long?
We were there for 11 months last year, going a little bit into 2007. And during that period, we were focused entirely on making art, which is our favorite thing to do. And India is, I guess, our favorite place to do that.
Seems to be, and you come back with some incredible pieces. You work in collaboration with some of the artisans.
I do. Charlotte has various miniature masters who she meets with and interacts with more as a peer or as a kind of parallel figure from another universe. But I actually employ craftsmen who are more like workers in my relation with them. At least that's been the general pattern in Varanasi. Though during this trip, for the first time, to my great delight, I was able to work with a group of craftsmen, or perhaps I should even say artists, in Nepal who are operating at such a level of mastery and with such extraordinary design capabilities that it was really much more of a collaboration, something that I've always wanted. I could propose an idea, and they could draw it. We could talk about how it would be made, and they could then make it, as opposed to my having to give constant input on every level and generally feel somewhat frustrated with the quality of the work. In this case, their own standards surpassed mine. So it was.
How did you connect with these people?
Well, Charlotte had a Fulbright Fellowship, which ran for 9 months from our arrival in late February into September. And part of our obligation,
November,
part of our obligation was to spend at least 6 weeks, I think, or was it a month, two months in Nepal. And this became very problematic because when we arrived in India, Nepal was in a state of upheaval. There was a lot of protest against the king, and there were the Maoists at the other extreme creating a lot of edginess and some danger out in the countryside. And there were massive strikes. And in fact, we were scheduled to go, I guess, in April. Mm-hmm. And just as we were about to go, there was a kind of exodus on the part of embassy personnel and Americans in general, including many, if not all, of the Fulbrighters. And we were in touch with the director of the Fulbright organization there to see if we could go. And we were told not to go in, I think it was June when we planned to go. So we went into the Himalayas and toured around a little bit. But by July, a magnificent, peaceful resolution of the problem had been achieved, which has been heralded in documentary films and perhaps in some books that I've never seen. But it was quite marvelous that there was very little bloodshed, almost none, and the king agreed to cede certain of his powers, and things kind of returned to their dismal usual state in Kathmandu. We didn't realize how dismal till we got there. So in July, or was it late June? I think late June.
It was July, because June we were in Himachal. Yeah,
we got there, and I had aspirations of contacting some craftsmen who I'd met a decade before. I'd had a Fulbright to India and Nepal, and I'd met this one family, descendants of the Buddha, actually. Rajkumar Shakya is the leading son among the elder son among three brothers, who are the sons of a kind of not very successful sculptor, whose father was an extremely prominent figure, who had made a lot of repoussé work and also done some glorious drawings, one of which was featured in the recent show that appeared at the Chicago Art Institute, and in fact it was donated to the Freer in Washington. I don't know this gentleman's first name, but he'd made this magnificent image of the Buddha on a huge piece of rice paper, done in kind of calligraphic style with black ink, and just a glorious, glorious drawing. It was sort of the entryway centerpiece of the installation of the Art of the Himalayas show that was a couple of years ago at the Chicago Art Institute. I had known about this drawing and known about the lineage situation of the family and had met them a decade before. I was under the impression that there was no hope that they would ever be collaborators of mine, because I knew that they were very prestigious and high-level workers whose services went for a premium. And when I got to Nepal, I contacted a professor who I had met very, very briefly on my previous visit. This had been a decade before. Mukunda Arial, who teaches at Tribhuvan University. And I showed him some of my work, and he said, "You have to collaborate with Rajkumar Shakya." And I said, "Well, I'd love to, but I don't think there's any way I could ever afford to work with them." And he said, "Let me take care of it. I'll arrange the whole thing." And we went a few days later and met with Rajkumar. And he told me later that Rajkumar should be careful not to kill the goose that lays the golden egg, implying that somehow if he would work for me at a discounted rate, maybe someday we'd do some business that was more lucrative for him. And Rajkumar was incredibly busy. He's making a statue of Padmasambhava, who is the figure who, presumably historical, though perhaps largely mythic, who brought Buddhism to Tibet on its way later to China and elsewhere. He was kind of a king, but he was also, I guess, a saintly figure. He's always represented in a kind of, he's not shown in the kind of monk's robes, but more in a royal garb, but he has a humility. He sits with boots on and kind of elegant. He's very elegant and looks very powerful. And it turns out that the Shakya family has a commission right now to make a version of this image that's going to be installed in Bhutan, which will be, I think, 108 feet tall. The Statue of Liberty is something like 60 or 80 feet. So this is going to be the largest repoussé sculpture ever made. It's going to have stairways inside of it.
Wow.
And simultaneously, they were making these chortens for installation in people's homes that were totally encrusted with gemstones that were amazingly beautiful, very detailed workmanship in gold and silver with very large gems that cost 50,000 and up, that were for various luminaries. Typically, there would be one made for a Tibetan or Bhutanese monastery, and a second piece that was going to New York City to some major patron of the Buddhist art scene who would, in fact, be paying for this item. And there were all these works in progress, and they were very behind on deadlines, but they agreed to work with me, and we produced four pieces together, one of which is still unfinished. It's sort of typical that when I leave, the work immediately gets put aside. When I go back, I will have to argue with them to finish the last one. But three of the pieces are finished and are really, in my work, quite extraordinary.
Is one of those the piece that's in the show here?
No.
No, that's another piece.
I wasn't able to bring them back. Okay. They're bigger.
They're not back yet.
No, they're all in India. I didn't ship any of my work back because I knew that I was going into a mode of a transition of my studio, and I didn't have any place to put things or finish work. So,
how many times have you been to India now?
Well, I've kind of lost count.
When did you first start to connect with India and
You wrote down 9 times since 1992.
I think that's about right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we went many times before that as students of Maharishi's. We went in 1970 to become teachers of transcendental meditation. And we went back maybe 3, 4, 5 times after that to attend courses. And during some of these courses, we began to discover that Indian art and Indian culture were of great interest to us.
That was Michael. I mean, your story that you just told gave rise to probably at least 12 questions for me. And one of them was, that was a fascinating story about how you began to collaborate with this man on this trip. And it made me curious, Charlotte, how you first came to know these miniature artists and how that whole process began for you.
It was a really great good fortune. Michael had a Fulbright in 1996 and 97 to be in India. And before that, he and Mark Petrick had taken a trip through India looking at all the great, great works of art, all the great temples. They went through the south and went to all the great temples and then to the north. And when they were in Jaipur, a lady who used to live here named Terry Tucker, she used to sell artwork. Mm-hmm. She introduced them to the greatest miniaturist alive at the time. His name was
Banu Sharma,
but he has another name, Vid. Anyway, Banu Sharma. He is the 7th in line in a tradition of painters who have done miniatures. Although his
the seventh
father,
generation.
Seven, he's the 7th generation, sitting in the same studio that they all worked in. And he was just an amazing man. And I was introduced to him. But before I was introduced to him, I had decided I would like to spend some time with him. So I, in the manner of most Indian miniaturists, I copied one of his pieces as perfectly, nearly perfectly as I could. And I brought it to him, and he said, "You did this?" And I said, "Yes." He said, you'll study with me."
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It was very sweet. But before that, actually, Michael was looking for some craftsmen to work with, and it was hot. It was summertime. So a friend of ours who was the director of the Handicraft Museum in Delhi, a very fine gentleman named Dr. Jain, suggested that we go to Chamba, a little village high up in the Himalayas in Himachal Pradesh, where there was a sculptor named Hakam Singh that Michael could work with. Well, as soon as we arrived in Chamba, the word got out that we were there, and Hakam's best buddy named Vijay Sharma, now all Sharmas in certain parts of India are painters, they're miniaturists, he introduced himself to me and he said, come paint with me. And I said, well, I'd love to, but I'm doing my own work now. I don't need to be with you. And he said, no. He said, what kind of work are you doing? I said, I do oil paintings. He said, oil? You don't want to work with oils. He said, they're the worst. He said, come work with the water-based paints that I work with. So I said, okay, I'll give it a try. Well, before I knew it, I was just completely hooked by his little squirrel hair brushes and mineral pigments and even just poster colors on antique paper from Jaipur. Antique means it's over 50 years old and little worms have not gotten into it. And a lot of it's written on. And I started painting. And then from there, I copied Banu Sharma's piece because Vijay knew I wanted to study with Banu. And I copied this illustration. They're illustrators. They're all illustrators. And it's marvelous because they really know how to draw. Mm-hmm. And I went to Jaipur and showed it to Banu, and he said, you stay and work with me, and I did. And my family all went back. At that time, it was still hot. It was September. It's very hot. They all went back up into the Himalayas, and I stayed in Jaipur for well over a month, and I visited with Banu every day. He never taught me anything. I just sat there and watched him. And I watched him paint, and he painted as if he were dancing. His hands simply danced over the page, just danced. And the few things he said to me, I remember one quite clearly, as he said, Saraswati, she lives in your heart. She's the goddess of knowledge and the goddess of creativity. She lives in your heart. And if you pray to her in the morning before you paint, he said, her knowledge, or rather she, will move up from your heart, down your arm, to the very tip of the brush, and that's where the life is. It's at the tip of the brush. He said, do not let that knowledge go into your brain. He said, Saraswati will not come through then. And I've always remembered this because...
I love that.
Right now, I mean, it seems to me that all of the art, not only in New York City, Chicago, L.A., and Delhi, and Mumbai, has to do with ideas. Nobody is dealing with, as Banu would say, Saraswati. Saraswati, how you pronounce it. And that was really a breakthrough for me, and I've always stayed with it. And the other thing he told me was, learn to paint a line. Just learn to paint lines. I said, well, how long will it take me so that I can make a line the way you do? I mean, he could take his hand and just make a perfect circle, a line like this that would go, and then it would go like, he was just incredible. It was dancing with that line. And I said, how long will it take me to do what you do? And he said, oh, 20 years. I said, Banu, I'll be over 70 at that time. And he looked at me and said, well, at least you'll have the experience before you die.
Wow, I love it.
And I know what he means by that. It's the experience of painting. It's not the product that matters.
There you go. That's my whole
theme. And it's just... He's just changed my life.
What a wonderful story.
He died shortly afterwards.
Does he have actually, a son that's carrying on the tradition?
He has two sons, and neither of them are carrying it on. One of them is a painter. He does paintings, large paintings on fabric. He's definitely painting to sell. Mm. Or he was when I saw him. He might have changed. Banu was not painting to sell.
Mm-mm, he sounded like a real
master. Was painting for the transcendent quality that comes from the activity of painting itself. And I remember years ago when I was with Maharishi, he said Charlotte should go to her room and paint for 3 days. This, you know, and I realized right then he was saying, this is your medicine. Go. It's going to make you feel good. Mm. And it has. I have to paint every day. If I don't, I feel bad.
Seems to be what sustains you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
This last trip that you made when you were working on the Fulbright, mm-hmm. Did you have a different focus or angle than usual, or was it just kind of a deeper level of the same?
I just paint thing? Just every paint. Day. I have no ideas. I mean, of course I have ideas. Oh, well, now I think I'd like to do something that's a little less having to do with imagery, a little few less lotuses or this or that, you know, but... Painting is painting. It's like you start for a walk and you don't know what's going to happen on your walk. You might see a robin, you might do this. You start painting and those lines start coming, and before you know it, you're filling something in and you hadn't planned on doing that.
Beautiful.
Yeah. I started using a lot of color this time, which I haven't in the past.
The color was spectacular in these new
Part batches. Of it was, I saw Vijay early on. Vijay was the artist from Chamba. He's very well known for his pahari or hill style paintings. They're the ones that have the yellow and the orange backgrounds. And the reason why they're so beautiful is they use these mineral colors and then they burnish them. And I started doing that, and oh, it is fun. I can't tell you.
Before our time runs out, just, you know, and then we can continue it, but I just want you to mention the show that's coming up. Of your work, you having...
When I was in India, I had been there painting every single day, nonstop, not trying to paint any number of paintings or do them for anyone or anything, although I always do think of Bill and Icon Gallery. But I must have painted about 50 paintings at that point. It was September or so. And I received an e-message from the director of the Des Moines Museum saying I would like to give you a, you know, one-person show along with three other people, but, you know, it'll be your own show. In April, do you think you can do it? And I thought, hey, this is perfect. I've got all these paintings. And when I brought them back to him, he just chose them, and that was it. I have no idea what the show will look like or anything. The opening party is this Thursday, the 26th, between 6 o'clock and 8 at night. And the Des Moines Art Museum is actually charging a little fee to go to the party because they're serving food.
We should think
but
about that.
Then it then it opens. Then the show opens the following day, and it's opened every day in their downtown gallery, not in the Grand.
This is in the Wells Fargo Building.
Yes,
the ground floor downtown Des Moines.
Yes, and it's opened every day.
Des Moines Arts Center is actually what I think it's
from
called.
11 to 5, perhaps. Except
I don't know
on Mondays.
They can call
something
or
like
else.
That.
The opening is the Thursday, the 26th. What time? Do you know?
I'd say 6 to 8.
Oh, okay.
And it runs through August 3rd. And I'm very pleased.
Now, you've been invited to show in Varanasi in one of the major kind of contemporary galleries.
Yeah, he's just getting to be a big gallery.
They have traditional and contemporary and photography, is that right?
Yeah. He's showing only miniatures and photography. And some of his miniaturists are really classic miniaturists. And some of them are more contemporary Indian artists. And he's not showing them so much anymore. He really wants to show miniaturists. Mm. And his classic miniaturists are now doing more contemporary things in the miniature style, which makes me fit in nicely.
Yeah.
It's a very
sweet
gallery.
Well, now, that brings up a point. You have really integrated your background as a Western abstract painter, very interested in pattern, and you did fabric and needlework type pieces with strong patterning. And you've combined that sensibility with what you've learned studying the traditional Indian painting. And it's a marvelous synergy that's happened in that.
It's fun. It's just fun. Basically, it has to do with using this little squirrel hair brush, which Bano used to say was alive, because they don't kill the animal when they take the fur. They grab the little animal. First they catch it in a cage, and then they grab the animal with the little head with their two fingers. And these are not squirrels like our squirrels. These are more like chipmunks. And they hold the animal so that it doesn't bite them, and then they dunk its tail into a pail of water, and they clip off the fur and let the animal go. So there's your live fur brush. And they're wonderful. These brushes have a little curve to them, so that as you, they're not pointed like our sable brushes. They also use sable brushes, but they're curved so that when you're making a line, the brush follows your hand. It's not that the point is there with your fingers. It's like you pull the point around.
Wow.
It's just beautiful. And it goes from thick to thin. And the lighter you are with your hand, the thinner the line is. And it's a trick. I've been doing it now for 10 years. I still haven't done the 20 years that Bano talked about. But I am beginning to really feel different about it. I can make a straight line now. I'm not very good at making a perfect circle, but I can do the straight line.
Well, it's really a pleasure to have you guys in our studio today. I feel like I've got a treasure here, and I don't even know where we can go from here. I think we should do a second show and do it next week. And I would like to go back a little bit over the history of you as artists, a sort of a verbal retrospective. I think that'd be kind of fun.
One thing we might mention about Charlotte is that she's using a kind of classical technique. The style of miniature painting that she has studied and is practicing when she's using these wonderfully flexible brushes is classical. But her subject matter, sometimes derived from fabric, which could be kind of high art, is often derived from folk art. In particular, She's been very intrigued by columns, which are designs that ladies make outside their homes on their threshold daily. They're kind of geometric patterns that perhaps relate a little bit to Pennsylvania Dutch hex signs or various other kinds of ritual images that are found all over the world. And Charlotte has been sort of reenacting these forms using this classic method. So it's an interesting mix of a folk tradition with a classic tradition.
Well, I think her work is a marvelous integration of various inputs. Well, and everyone should see this show in Des Moines. I can't wait to see it.
And also come to, if you haven't been to Icon Gallery to see the show that's currently up there, Michael has a piece and Charlotte has some paintings there. And the gallery is now open
Tuesday through Saturday, noon to 4.
Noon to 4. So, yeah, make sure you stop in because they're just so moving. And
that's on the square, the west side of the square. The old Gobbles building is now Icon Gallery. We have a minute left. Let's hear a parting word from Michael.
Well, I think that Charlotte and I have both been so fortunate to have had the inspiration of India over such a long time. It has provided us both with a really different idea as to what art can be. And one of the great bases of this whole encounter has been our engagement with meditation and consciousness. But to then take this receptiveness on our part and our orientation background as artists to India and be able to plug it in to the incredible richness that has proliferated over so many centuries there in Indian tradition, and then try to integrate this, bring it back to the West as contemporary world art, has been a delightful adventure and one that we are, in a way, just beginning. So we look forward to continuing this.
Well, I hope you continue many more years to bring back this richness from India and bring it to us through yourselves. Thank you so much for coming.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.